Men on Board, episode 52. Today, the category is habitat building. We're going to be talking about underwater cities and terraforming Mars. In our broader view, we're going to be talking about the effects of repeated play on strategy. Hello, and thank you for downloading Men on Board. My name is Aaron.
This is Josh.
Jameson.
And I'm Matt.
And if you are listening to us for the first time, this is our little podcast about a couple of friends that play board games and then compare them. And then
it has been a really long time since you did one of those.
Yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. Hey, welcome.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like you go through the effort of like finding, like, I don't imagine the podcast listener that's just like, oh, I'm just gonna listen to any random podcast and just see what the content
on
is
on episode 53.
Yeah, 52.
Yeah. Well, don't you always start with the most recent episode on a podcast?
That
sometimes,
actually is,
but I at least
true
know
a lot.
What's it, like, I don't need an introduction necessarily most of the time, but I do often start with most recent episode.
It depends. Like, sometimes I'll listen to the most recent ones and then go back to the very beginning and then catch up. It depends on what the kind of content is.
I work back based on what I like.
Oh, so you go backwards.
Yeah.
I don't like that, because sometimes like there's like stuff that gets built up on each other.
No.
And like it's weird for me.
I listen to the newest one unless it sounds like it's really weird, like different. Then I go back about 10 episodes if I actually like it and I work my way forward.
It depends on the podcast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
If it is talking about games, then I want to like know the most recent games or things that I'm thinking
about.
No,
that's true. I guess I do that with gaming podcasts.
Like other podcasts.
If it's like an interview podcast, like when I listen to the Nerdist, like the original Nerdist podcast, I would listen to it backwards because I tried to listen to like one of the oldest episodes first, and just the quality and the rhythm was bad. So by listening to it backwards, it invested me in the podcast to make me, as the episodes were getting worse as I was going back in time, it made me able to handle the crappier episodes
and I
in
like,
quality.
I like episodic, like I like a self-contained, I want a theme, a topic, and like if I listen to a podcast, it's because I want to learn something or like have a specific, oh, I want to know that, that interests me, click, listen, done.
No, I thought about it because it's really, it's the more serialized podcasts that are telling a story that
right.
way. I mean, obviously, I'm going to go back to the beginning. I'm not going to jump in, but like, yeah, with gaming podcasts, I typically will go recent and then keep listening or I'll look in their back catalog.
Because if their recent coverage isn't up to snuff for what I'm looking at, then I'm like, okay, well, you're behind. I don't care about you.
But anyway, we are not a podcast about other podcasts. We are a podcast about board games.
That's what we're a podcast of. And Jameson.
One of our episodes will just be comparing two board game podcasts, and then we'll do a comparison and broader view.
That's actually, I'm going to put that on the Trello.
Recommendations. So I feel like people would listen to that. I just don't feel like we want to be that podcast.
We should talk about games.
We should, and we are. And specifically, we are talking about, well, we're calling this episode Habitat Building, but these two games have a lot in common. They're both really popular. Well, one's super popular. The other one's getting a lot of good buzz right now as a newer game. They have similar habitat themes. They have engine building things going on.
They both have expansions coming out.
Yeah, there's a lot in common with these two. So we figured this was the time to talk about them. And that's what we're doing. And the games we're talking about are Terraforming Mars. You heard the intro. It's Terraforming Mars and Underwater Cities. And we're going to start with Underwater Cities because it's more recent. And I am going to be doing the game breakdown for Underwater Cities. So Underwater Cities was published in 2018. It was designed by Vladimir Succi with art by, and I apologize, Vildrum and Milan Vavron. It was published by Delicious Games, and it distributed in the United States by Rio Grande Games. So right off the bat, Underwater Cities has a lot going on, so this is going to be a top-level kind of description of the game, but here we go. Underwater Cities is a worker placement and engine-building game where players are competing to build the best underwater nation consisting of an archipelago of dome cities connected by a network of transportation tunnels. The game consists of a central board that is double-sided to accommodate for different player counts. The board consists mainly of a number of different worker placement locations, but also has a score track, round marker, and slots for a card market. Players each have their own personal player board, where they will be building their underwater nation, with the outlines for areas where they can build domes, tunnels, and different buildings. players will be building a tableau of cards throughout the game, but at the start of the game, they're only going to have a single personal assistant card. Players also receive some starting resources and a starting hand of cards, and three workers that are referred to as action tiles. They're pretty much just tiles that mark where you're taking your actions. A round of the game will have players taking turns in an order that varies from round to round. On a player's turn, they will be using one of their action tiles to take an unclaimed action slot from the board and playing a card from their hand. The card and action slots will have one of three different colors. If the color of the action matches the color of the player's card, then the player will be able to use the action from the slot as well as the effect from the card. If the colors do not match, the player will just be taking the action from the action slot and discarding the card. There are too many individual action slots to go over, but the majority of them will allow players to collect one or more of the available resources, or to build or upgrade one or more of the structures on their individual player boards. Some of the fringe actions will allow players to collect special cards, adjust their position in the turn order for the next round, draw cards, or use the actions on cards that are in their tableau. Cards in the game will fall into five different types: immediate effects that are used and then discarded, action cards that can be placed in a player's tableau to then be used throughout the game, permanent effects that will give players certain bonuses when they are triggered by specific game conditions, production cards that will give players additional resources during the production phase, and endgame scoring cards that will give players points at the end of the game for meeting certain conditions. The game is played over 10 rounds, which are split up into three eras. At the end of each era, players will go into production phase, where the buildings that they have constructed and connected to their nation will produce resources. These buildings exist in three different types and are placed in designated areas outside of the dome cities. The buildings will have different yields depending on if they are upgraded or depending on if a city has an upgraded pair of the same type of building. In addition to buildings, tunnels and certain types of domes can also generate resources or points. At the end of the production phase, players will have an opportunity to reset their action cards for the upcoming round, and then will have to feed their connected cities using their generated resources. At the end of the final round, after production phase, players will enter an endgame scoring phase, where in addition to the points that the players accumulated throughout the game, players will gain points from their personal endgame scoring conditions, their connected cities and how diversified their buildings are, and their resources they have left over at the end of the game. Once scores are totaled, the player with the most points is considered to have built the most successful underwater nation and is declared to be the winner.
I think one place to start is sort of expectations against reality. I think that the artwork of the game, the concept of the game, had me wondering what kind of direction it could go. I was, you know, I wasn't sure if it was going to be something more, you know, sinister, but in kind of a goofy way, like BioShock. If it was going to be something really slick and goofy, if it was going to be full camp, like I really didn't know what was going to happen with it. And I actually kind of feel like it didn't really do anything. I feel like it took a couple of steps in different directions, but at the end of the day, there isn't a whole lot of flavor here. It feels kind of corporate. And because of that, and maybe it's intentional, but because of that, my attention was very much on the mechanics over the theme. Theme definitely came in, but I didn't really feel like I was, you know, exploring underwater. I didn't feel like there was that going for it.
So this to me is a Euro game at heart, I would say. It has a really strong emphasis on, as Jameson sort of hinted at, and I'm going to echo, the mechanics of this game are definitely what make the game. The play structure and the way in which you're taking your action in this game feel, I don't want to say prescripted, but there is sort of a do this, then do that thing that you're building. And the game does, at the end of it, give you a strong sense of having built something that works for you throughout the game. I really enjoyed my plays of this game. I have a few criticisms and a few critiques, but I think if you're a fan of this genre and you like the idea of sitting down, having a sort of a map of options in front of you that are very limited by the board state, and I think that's what the most unique thing in this game to me is, are the different ways you take your actions in the board, and you want sort of that calculated factor, you'll really enjoy this game and find a lot to grab a hold of. I think there's a lot of depth here, and there's some subtle point scoring things that I didn't appreciate on my first play that sort of revealed themselves with further plays.
Yeah, I agree with all that. I mean, I think the theme, I get the theme a little bit more, I think, than everyone else does. I mean, I won't go as far as saying it's pasted on, because they do a nice little thing with the components. Like, I like the little domes. Like, I like looking down at my little city and, like, saying, like, my little constructed thing and how it's built, and it feels really cool. But then there are, like, some things that, you know, like, taking action, playing a card, and like when you read the names of the cards in your tableau, okay, like I see what they're kind of like getting at with it, but it's not the strongest theme. But I agree, Josh, the game's entirely within the mechanics. What I like on this game is that I can go into my turn and I can really, really hope for a certain action. And if it's there most of the time, I can still figure out something else that I can do to be beneficial. But this game can get really tight with like really wanting that certain action.
Yeah, it really does become mandatory to like, I have to get here.
Yeah.
Which I remember playing and I think walking away like, that was an okay game. But then that night, like I was sitting around thinking about it, and I think it was because of the mechanics that I was like, okay, if I had, like, if this was on the table in front of me again, this is what I would do differently. Mm. Like, I can see how the game would play out. And I think that comes from like, I don't care about the theme. Like, I just want to, if it's in front of me again, do these mechanics better. Like, I want to make a better use out of that, which I love Euros. So that's, to me, is perfect. Like, because that's what I like in my, like, to the games that I really like. I think just the flip side of that is, I don't know if I was presented with anything particular to Underwater Cities that would make me have to buy it to scratch the itch that there aren't, like, four other games in my collection where I'm doing that same kind of action optimization with card playing. That doesn't make Underwater Cities bad. I think if you, I think it's going to scratch a similar itch for a lot of people to other games.
It's not breaking any new ground.
Right.
I see what you're saying there. I don't completely agree with you, only because I think if what you're looking for in this game, and what I wasn't prepared for, particularly in our first play of this game, was a two-player game, and it wasn't as evident there, but it certainly was there. But in three, and I can imagine, or four, three and four-player games, the competition for action spaces is much fiercer than you would find in a typical Euro game. It's not that you're really trying to mess your other players around. It's just that there are so few spaces on the board to get what you need out of your turn. There are always options. Don't get me wrong. You're not limited, but you have to calculate very closely what options you have available to you. So there is a high level of interactivity and possibly messing over another player's turn that you might not be prepared for. And a lot of straight Euro games don't offer that kind of interactivity. Now, some people are not going to like that at all. I have mixed feelings on the way it played out in one of our games and some other feelings about the way it played out in another game. So I've experienced two sides of it now. But detailing a little bit further, the way this game has the action spaces and the way that you have a handful of cards, your cards won't always match the action spaces on the board. And you want them to. I'm pretty fairly convinced that you really... you don't want to play, I'm going to call it off suit, but playing a card that matches the action spaces on the board is significantly more powerful than not doing that, just because of the action turn economy in the game and because the turns are limited and you have a lot of things you want to accomplish. So there are many times in the game that you will play a card that may be suboptimal just to get that match there. And that's weird. I still don't quite know how I feel about that game, the game pushing me in that direction all the time.
Yeah, I definitely noticed that. Every time I did something that wasn't a perfect match, and I was even getting rewarded for it. I even had a card out early that was letting me get something out of a mismatch. Anytime I played off suit, I felt like I was shooting myself in the foot, because every turn felt so important, especially when I had the initiative. And that kind of gets me back to something that Josh said a minute ago. Not only is the level of competition over the actions unusual in my experience for a Euro, but there's also way less control over turn order. Normally, in my experience with this kind of game, when there is that disparity, the person who is not getting to do what they want have a way of essentially jumping first in line for the next round. That's definitely not the case here. There's a lot of competition that can happen over turn order, and the way that the actions are structured, it might not even be a central goal of the people who are moving up.
Yeah, because a lot of there's only so many spots on the board that can control your turn order. So if you don't have an engine built up towards turnover, or like cards you can discard in order to boost yourself up on the turn order, it does get kind of punishing and limiting.
Definitely. And having a card that was letting me move up in turn order without having to ever use that space was super handy.
Mm-hmm.
But it did keep us most of the game in the exact same turn order. Aaron and I kept being towards the beginning of turn order a lot, because when we were already going first, we could take the actions that would move us up in turn order to secure it. And Josh in particular was stuck in fourth almost the whole game because the actions were already gone to move up in turn order by the time it got to his turn. That being said, you won.
I did.
And it obviously didn't hurt that much because you got around it, but I'm sure it was like still frustrating always being stuck in the back.
Yeah, you can have a frustrating game experience and still win, or a really satisfying game experience and still lose. And I don't think you were seriously saying the other thing either. I do think that Josh was successful in spite of the time that he was having for a big chunk of it. I think that what makes it more chaotic, too, is that a lot of the turn order actions, I think there's only one that's a pure turn order action. All of the others, it's just kind of an add-on. And so when I was moving up in turn order, it was almost never because I was doing that deliberately. It was usually because there was an available space that had something else I really needed, and the turn order was just a bonus. The benefits for moving up in turn order, too, actually seemed kind of weird. It was so important that on top of that, giving you rewards for pushing it higher and higher seemed to be piling on.
Yeah, I don't know if that was necessary. To be rewarded for moving up in turn orders, now it's like, you get to go earlier next round, and here's an extra money. Like,
but it's also...
And then victory points. If you go fast enough, victory points.
If you just need one extra money, that's a great place to go, though.
And I did that to do that, but I don't know if it's necessary for that to be there.
But they were like the resources you get are like the bottom tier resources because it's like the money and the steel plasts. Like, it's not like you're getting like the biomatter, which is like
but
a wild
resource. That's the stuff
resource.
I couldn't get.
Yeah.
Like, I never had money in steel. I just couldn't generate it from any of the cards I had.
Yeah.
So it was helpful to me, but it still felt weird to be like, it just felt weird to be like, I'm going to move up on turn order, I guess, when I don't need to at the moment.
And I'll say to that, Matt, too, I think teaching this game to anyone who's going to teach this game, showing the players what their first production phase is going to look like. There's a nice player aid, but it still doesn't, you don't quite get the tangible feel of how the game's going to build, you know, towards your second and third era, because there's very few production events. There's only three in the entire game, and you're pretty much going to spend all the resources that you make usually in the first or second production, I feel like. Like, the game might incentivize you to produce a bunch of things or to specialize in something, but you also have to be doing a lot of things throughout the course of the game because you don't always know that you have the engine to just use one type of resource or you can only do one thing. And the way this endgame scoring works, particularly in building different varieties of buildings or structures onto your cities, forced you to diversify because all those buildings require different resources. So I almost think you can't build a super strong one resource type engine and do amazingly well in that particular aspect of the endgame scoring.
On endgame scoring, like this game, again, this isn't something that like breaks any new ground or anything. I like games that give you that option of like, here are your possibilities for endgame scoring. So, because like in this game, you deal out at the very beginning six cards that will all have an endgame scoring bonus on it, but only one person is going to be able to claim each of those cards. So I like that it has that balance of saying, I'm going to craft my game towards this, as well as the fact that someone else could beat you to getting that card. Because it takes an action to get it, and it's kind of expensive to play it. So you could be doing something better. Like, you could be playing a card that gives you an immediate effect or effect that's helping you throughout the game as opposed to end game. And I like that kind of struggle as to, when am I going to do this? When am I going to... It's a push your luck that is just enough that I'm okay with it.
And you have to pay to get those end game scoring cards into effect, too. Just claiming them is enough. You still have to have the resources to put them in your tableau to get them to score for you by the end, too, which is different than many other games I know of in this genre.
Yeah, that'll go to our meta topic a little bit, but that is not some, you know, that's an easy rule to forget just when you're doing it for the first time. So that was definitely something that would have been different had I been playing it for a second or a third time.
One of the problems that I had with this game, and one of my critiques of this game, was that I left the table winning but having a really frustrating play experience. And that was a very clear experience I felt, specifically because of the way the game structured the turn order and the limitation of the actions. Now, I'm not saying I wasn't able to do things, but my experience playing the game, and something to be significantly aware of, the game can drag, particularly with more players, because if your action spot is taken, you then have to rethink your entire action, and it can get quite complicated. So there can be significant downtime if a player snatches the action you take, which is very likely. It happened to me a lot in later plays. And I mean, I'm a player that doesn't agonize over his decisions too much, but still, there's a lot of thought process that goes into this game, and it can kind of get frustrated and drag when you just want to do one simple thing, but someone took that action. So now you have to refigure out if it's even possible or when you have to do it. So there's a significant element of timing during this game, which you want, but there's also less control than I would like, I think, in this game.
I agree with that. I think you can get really messed up by someone else's actions. And it's kind of, it's interesting because you specifically cannot hate draft in this game. Like, you can't block someone out of an action, because if you can't take the action, then you're not allowed to like put your little thing out to block someone else. But because there's only so few possible actions on the board, inevitably you're going to get blocked out of something.
The most useful action, and I'm so glad they included it in this one, was the ability to duplicate another action on the board. That is part of the game, and it is critical.
But you only get that at four players. So at three players, you don't have that option.
Scratch that from the record, then.
No.
That would make it very different, because,
I agree.
Yeah.
I mean, three players, you have, like, you know, three less markers going out. But, like,
but there's still only two spaces to do the action. Like, you build the action. Anyway, this is a lot of detailed stuff.
No, it's okay, because I've played this game at 2, 3, and 4. Yeah. And I actually like it at all the player counts, because they all have their pros and cons compared to each other.
Yeah. I would not do four again, I think.
Four is a lot. It's a lot of downtime. Mm-hmm. And it's a lot of competition. One last thought on this game before we move on. One of the small rules that I just love that they did is that you have a hand limit of 3 cards, but it's not enforced at the start of your turn, so that you have everyone else's turn to figure out if you have to discard cards, what cards to discard. Because I really think that helps with like improving the flow of the game.
Yeah, if nothing else, it makes it go much faster. You have something to do during the downtime.
I think that we have did a really thorough exploration of Underwater Cities.
Well, you said there's a lot to this game.
There is. It's a lot to it. And there's a lot to the next one. So I feel like this is going to be a long episode, but I feel like that's okay for these games.
Yeah.
But anyway, it's time to start looking at Terraforming Mars. And Matt is going to be introducing that game for us.
So Terraforming Mars was published in 2016. It was designed by Jacob Frieselius with art by Isaac Frieselius. So Terraforming Mars is a resource management and card laying game where each player is a different corporation that is assisting in humanity's terraforming project on Mars in order to make it more habitable. A game of Terraforming Mars is played over several rounds, the goal of which is to earn victory points and increase your terraforming rating. And your terraforming rating is basically how helpful you've been towards the collective goals of raising the temperature on Mars, increasing the amount of oxygen in the air, and creating oceans. Each round of the game is known as a generation and has 4 phases. Phase 1 is the player order phase, and this is simply rotating first player clockwise and advancing the round marker. Phase 2 is the research phase, where each player will get to draw 4 cards, also known as projects, and has the opportunity to keep any or none of them, paying 3 money to research the project, which allows the player to hold onto the card. Phase 3 is the action phase, and this is the bulk of the game. At each turn, a player is allowed to take 1 or 2 actions, or they can pass, which takes them out of the rest of the round. Actions include playing a card from your hand, which means paying its cost, and then once the card is played, it'll sometimes give a lingering effect or a one-time effect, any kind of different abilities with the card. You can then also use one of the standard actions printed on the board. You can claim a milestone, which are special goals that a player can claim by being the first to accomplish some task, like having 3 cities built or owning a certain number of forests on the board. Players can also fund an award, and these are endgame scoring bonuses, which will usually involve having more of something than your opponent's. However, someone must pay the money to fund the reward, though this does not mean that they will win the points at the end of the game. It just means that this award will be scored by all the players at the table. Players can also use an action printed on any one of their cards. Players can also trade in 8 of the plant resource to build a forest on Mars, which is what helps raise the oxygen levels. Or they can pay 8 heat resource to raise the temperature of the planet. After all players have taken their actions and everyone has passed, play moves on to the production phase, where players will all look at their personal boards and collect an amount of each resource dependent on their production level for it. Players will also earn bonus money for having a good terraforming rating as a reward for helping everyone have a better life on Mars. The game will end once the heat, oxygen level, and ocean levels are all at acceptable levels, and then players will score points for their level of terraforming rating, any rewards and milestones, points printed on the game board, any tiles they've placed on the game board, or any of the cards in their tableau. The player with the most points wins, and ties are broken in favor of whoever has the most money.
So I want to start this off with a poll of the table. How heavy would you rate this game?
Medium?
I think it's heavier than it feels. The game is, so just talking about theme briefly, it's so engaging for me at beginning, middle, and end that it felt to me like there was less to keep track of because I was doing the things that, I was naturally doing things that led to the decisions that I wanted to be making anyway. I do think there's a lot going on. There's definitely a lot going on, but it didn't feel that heavy to me.
The play of this game is deceptively simple, but the depth of this game is richer than would appear on the surface level.
That's what I agree. Because I play this game a lot, and I know that you've played it even more than I have. And that's exactly how I feel as well, is that this is one of those, here is the surface level of the game, and have fun really digging into it.
I do feel, though, like when I was playing it with you guys, it wasn't your first time playing it. And I didn't come in, I don't think I came in first, but I had a pretty successful time. This is a game that is motivating as it goes and is fun as it goes. So just kind of talking briefly about frustration, I didn't have those moments here, even though it was new to me. Definitely, it's definitely a high cliff to doing exceptionally well. I can see this game having a really high skill ceiling, but it doesn't feel like the floor is super low.
Yeah, when I played this game for the first time with Josh, he had played a lot of times before playing with me and knew cards, like actual cards in the deck as they were coming up. And I beat him because of the breadth of the game, I just took a strategy path that Josh wasn't anticipating.
This game can vary strongly depending on how the players choose to approach their play of the game. Matt played a very quick terraforming heavy strategy that felt like a rush, and I was doing a slow build strategy. And the more I played this game, the way in which the game unfolds based on the people playing the game is one of those things you have to check into and be very aware of the pacing of the game and when it might likely end, because getting that extra generation or two can be a huge difference in points for engine building players versus players that want to terraform quickly. And it's a really interesting push-pull dynamic to this game. And that's that depth that comes out later, I think.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, Josh, because when I play this game, the way I want to play it is I want it to take a long time. I want to really build out my engine. I really want to like kind of get into like the whole theme of
Chris
terraforming the planet.
Hates when I rush this game.
But I think rushing it is the way to be more successful more often.
That was the only way I thought I could beat Josh. Because in my head, I was like, I can see loads of ways to make engine building. Josh is going to know them better than me because Josh has played this game before. So my only chance at winning is to try to end the game as quickly as possible before he gets an engine going that's too effective. That I'm just going to try to do like one-shot cards and cards with a lot of points.
Oceans. You just threw oceans
and
down.
I just kept throwing tiles onto the terraforming board because I was like, I am not going to be able to effectively do an engine as well as Josh. So I cannot let this game go too long. And I liked that the game let me do that.
Yeah.
That I was able to find a path in the game to be like, no, this game lasts like 6 turns. Like, it was over insanely fast.
Yeah,
and the
I
game
think it was
let
like 7 generations. It was real fast.
I feel like there's a lot of room to see what the other players are doing and do something else.
There is another level of this game, and it's one that I would encourage everyone to play with, and most people in the rulebook officially, and what most players online will play with is the draft variant, when you get your hand of 4 projects, not your initial starting cards, but your 4 projects per generation, I should say. You draft them to players back and forth and have the ability to eliminate possibilities from those players, and then you still have to purchase them on the road. I think it gives you that strategic ability to like respond a little bit more to what other players are doing to the table around you, to at least know some of the options of things that might be coming towards you in the game and choose, no, I don't want them to have the ability to do this. And it makes the game far richer to me.
I completely agree. I don't want to play this game without drafting. Our friend Ben, who is my go-to heavy gamer whenever I want to play like a heavy game with, and we agree on so much when it comes to games. Ben can't stand drafting in this game.
That's crazy.
I don't understand it. He explains to me that all it does is lets people deny him cards. And I see that. I understand that. However, when you're drawing your hand, like if someone draws a hand of four cards that work with their strategy and someone else draws a hand of four cards that have nothing to do with their strategy, there's an inherent unfairness about that. And whenever you're drafting, you're being guaranteed to look at, I mean, you're going to see nine cards to choose three from and then just end up with one other random one. I would always rather do that because mm-hmm. someone can't deny me every single card. Like I want to have that choice of being able to find the cards that are going to go for my strategy. And every single time, like Ben and I don't play this game together because it is a fundamental disagreement that we can't get past.
And
like,
we talked about this on our previous episode, I think, with Res Arcana, mm-hmm. a little bit about that strategy versus tactics kind of thing. But yeah, that's a big deal. And people on, I mean, this game has a huge following on BoardGameGeek. It's like number three on there. So if you're listening to this, I'm sure you know about this game.
And very well deserved.
Yep. And people, I mean, have strong preferences on the correct way to experience this game, more so than many other games, I think. And that draft is at the heart of this debate. But I'm with you, and I really enjoy the draft. I don't think it adds much more time. People will say that if you don't draft, you know, it will sort of distribute itself over time, that the randomness kind of equals out. Or you play a different strategy where you're not hunting for cards as specifically knowing you're going to see fewer of them. It's all fine. Whatever works for you. I also always play with the corporate era cards, and mm-hmm. I like Preludes. We don't talk about expansion in this game, but I really, really enjoy what Preludes offers you to start this game with. And I would choose to always play with that added expansion on if it were me.
100%. Prelude has been mixed because all my board games, they always have the expansions that are in like separate little baggies in the box. Prelude is fully mixed in because I do not want to play this game without Prelude. I love what it does. Fun. I mean, Venus Next, I can take it or leave it. I mean, it's nice for a variant, but like, I don't really need it in my game. I still haven't tried Colonies.
I'd like to do Colonies.
I'll try it eventually. Mm-hmm. It's never really jumped out at me. The Helios and
Elysium. I like them.
I like having that because I don't want to play the, because what Helios and Elysium. Jeez, well, I just got back from vacation today, so no, never mind. I just can't pronounce anything. What that does is, as Matt mentioned in the overview, that you have those milestones and the awards. That expansion is a double-sided board, so you can vary up what they are. So I like having that one in two because it's just like, okay, let's pick a board. Mm-hmm. And they also have different board layouts, but for me, and that does add a lot more strategy.
Yeah.
Because it switches up what like the meta of the game is. But having that option for different awards and different milestones is huge for me. Because with the base game, like it's like, okay, science tags are super useful because mm-hmm. it's like right there. When you take that away, it really changes the way you think about the game.
One of my favorite parts of this game, and it's why it maybe appeals to a higher level player or someone that wants to play a little bit more, but you get dealt a handful of 10 cards to start with, two corporations, two preludes if you play with preludes, and or four preludes, and you then are told, make this work. Like, these are your options, find whatever works. And I've seen any number of different strategies emerge. I've seen people buy every card in their hand to get the planner award, and they just instantly fund one of the awards on the thing and go for those moves. There's players that play quick strategy. They say, okay, well, each point should cost me 5 mega credits or no more than 4 mega credits at this stage of the game. Like, there's a lot that you can look at that initial hand of cards and figure out for yourself. Or you can say, I don't want any of these. I'm going to fund standard projects until I wait till round two. It's got some really interesting dynamics of play that emerge through it. I think the game has an incredible amount of depth to it.
And going back to like the breadth of strategy in the game, the tactics of stalling versus rushing and like that interplay of the pace of the game, because there's a lot of, maybe not a lot, there's a decent amount of indirect player interaction. Like you can't, and there's actually some direct player interaction, but controlling that pace, controlling when you're going to have the opportunity to take an action versus the board state is interesting to me. And I like trying to play towards those opportune moments.
I would actually say, I thought that playing with Josh, I thought there was a lot of direct player interaction. Like I remember playing a lot of cards that I was like, oh no, Josh, a meteor fell and all your trees a bird. Yeah. Like,
there was a lot of that too.
It depends, because sometimes I'll see games where I don't get as many of those mm-hmm, cards, and other times it's like a ton of those cards.
They can be expensive, and they might cost you points too at the end of the game. So you kind of have to weigh the pros and cons of situationally, is this worth it? And I think that's one of my favorite parts about this game is that you're very much playing your own game as your own corporation, but you're all playing in the same world. You're all playing on that same map. And so everything, all your actions are contributing to that map, which your opponents then have to react on and deal with and sort of respond to. And that, to me, gives a level of interaction that it does feel it's not cooperative in any way, shape, or form, but you all have to raise those terraforming requirements to get to the end state of the game. And that gives this game sort of a level of, like, almost cooperation and competitiveness that I don't find in a lot of other games, where at the end of the game you step back and say, oh, that's how we built Mars this time. All right, well, that looks different than, like, there's 10 cities on the board. Usually there's tons of trees, or there's all these oceans. Like, each play of this game can have a really different feel, but the ending feels very similar, and it feels like you've built and done a lot throughout the course of your play.
There's a clear narrative that emerges based on the corporations that you are, the path that you take, and you are all moving in the same direction, and that's a really special thing in this game.
Mm-hmm.
I love this game so much that I have to really search for a negative to give about this game.
Oh, you know what it is.
It's the art and components.
Yeah.
And I don't like the art and components in this game. I don't like that.
Not the board's good, though.
The board's good. The player boards, as they come in the box, are just flimsy pieces. Like, if someone happens to, like, move their hand the wrong way, you can mess up your entire tracking of everything, which is a problem. Resource cubes, the paint is chipping.
You should know what your production is. Like, I stare at my production board to the point that I'm not going to forget what I was producing.
But it's still, like,
it's frustrating.
You're absolutely right.
The mismatched art on the cards gets to me. And again, this is truly nitpicking right now because this game is so good, but I just want to say something critical of it. And the reason why is because this is an MSRP of $70. And
really?
Yes.
That was a lot. But
As we're recording this, I checked on Cool Stuff, and you can get on Cool Stuff for $50.
Okay.
But the MSRP is $70. And I believe I heard this may be incorrect, and I don't even know, because this is a very short, behind the scenes, this is going to be a very short turnaround between recording and releasing. So usually we'll double check these things, but I think this game is entirely manufactured in the United States. I could be wrong about that.
Interesting.
And I've heard that quoted as why the cost is so high. I do think that the game in here is amazing, and that, you know, when you're paying for a game, you're paying for so much outside of just, like, what's in the box. But at the same time, that's a higher price point for, you know, the typical Ticket to Ride size box that's on your shelf. And I just wish that the components inside the box were a little bit better. You can find it on good sale, but again, amazing game.
Like, yeah, you're going to get that money out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a nice, I don't know why, I find this game relaxing to play. Mm-hmm. It's, like, got a nice pace to it. Chris and I sit down and play it for, like, that's our evening activity. It might be an hour, it might be 2 hours, but, like, it's never really an hour.
Wow, that's a speed.
No,
point.
We're not that fast. Our play was pretty fast.
Yeah,
this
I think game. Josh and I played, like, an hour and a half together.
Okay, yeah, I've done that.
Hour and a half, 2 hours.
And that, like, was me learning.
Yeah. But it's, like, a nice pace. You sit down, you build cards. Every round has that, like, okay, what am I going to get now? Let's see what I can do. I just love this game. It's top three for me, at least, if not top one or two, I think, for my game that I could almost always play.
All right, so let's switch it over to comparison. And one thing that both of these games do that, like, I really like in a game is that as I progress through the game in both of these, I enjoy the feeling of getting more resources, because both of these games I feel very starved at the very beginning of the game, and I'm really trying to just edge out to get whatever I can done. And both of these games towards the end of the game, I'll start off and I was like, I have so many resources, like, I can do whatever I want, and again, I run out of resources. But I like that. I like games mm-hmm. that have that pace throughout them, where you start off very small, get to build up your engine, and just really capitalize on the whole engine building aspect of it. And that's completely separate, because both of their engines are through their cards, and that's just the end result of, like, of what your current production level is. And I appreciate that feeling from both of these games.
Yeah, I agree. I think both games have that. I think my plays throughs, the journeys were just different.
Mm-hmm.
That in Underwater Cities, I went from, like, zero production to two production. And in Terraforming Mars, it was like zero production to 97 production. Just the ride length in Terraforming Mars was exponentially greater by the time I got to the end. I was like, I'm making 20 of everything except for that stupid brown resource that I can't make any of it. But everything else, I'm, like, rolling in it. While Underwater Cities, it was like, oh, I got two of this instead of none of this. That's going to be slightly more helpful.
After leaving both these games, I'm still thinking about them. That's a mark of a great game to me. I like to be deeply engaged with the game, with the world, with the experience I just had, to the point that I want to leave it and go, oh, what if I did this different? Well, I could have done this. Oh, there was this opportunity that I might have missed during the game. And like, it makes me want to further my knowledge of the game to get better at them. And not all games give you that, but these two games definitely do.
These games make me feel like my choices are rewarded. Like, my strategy that I go for and like what I try to build towards, it rewards on that. And it kind of gives you like, okay, yeah, keep building this. And then like, maybe you'll be able to do this later. And I appreciate that. I appreciate games that will take a while and will take some thought, but will build off of the thought that you put into them.
Mm-hmm. For me, unusually, I think Underwater Cities is tighter than Terraforming Mars. There's more tension there. And I think that's because of the action spaces. And I think that's why I like it a little bit less. I like both these games. There's no doubt that I like Terraforming Mars more than I like Underwater Cities. They're both excellent games for what they offer. I think the gameplay of Underwater Cities might actually just be, which is weird for me to even say this, and I'm if you could see me right now, crossing my eyes and making a weird, goofy face, but it's weird that I feel more stressed out playing Underwater Cities. It feels limiting, and like I have pressure under me.
Could not agree with you more. Like
I get tired.
Underwater Cities, there's very, very little margin for error versus Terraforming Mars. Like, it's more forgiving of the mistakes and gives you more chances to come back versus Underwater Cities. It's like, oh man, I have to do all this before this round. And if I'm going to do this next round, I have to have all this stuff done. But oh no, Matt just took that space, so now my game's over. And versus like Terraforming Mars, it's like, oh, I guess I could play this card instead. Okay. And then maybe I'll just raise the oxygen.
Yeah. And I think, like, I know I've had a couple plays of Terraforming Mars where my opponent's gotten frustrated because they feel like they're too far behind and there's still a significant portion of game ahead. But the end game scoring is surprisingly equalizing. Like, all the points aren't, just seeing that Terraforming rating isn't the only thing that matters. And you don't always know what your opponent actually has, you know, in terms of what their cities are scoring, what their tiles are scoring, what their cards and their tableau are going to get them. So there's more ways to play that game than might be obvious just by saying, well, you're ahead of me on the Terraforming rating, therefore you're going to win.
Josh, when you talked about how you felt you were being very inefficient whenever you played an off-colored card in Underwater Cities, that's how I feel in Terraforming Mars when I take one of the standard projects. But yeah. I think that's just because my playstyle, I think those can be used so efficiently and so effectively, and I just think I don't play them efficiently or effectively.
That's an easy mistake to make. I think they're there for a reason, that when you need them and when you can capitalize on them, they're great to have, because having the ability to always do that for a certain amount of money, like, can be really powerful if your timing of getting the temperature up 1 degree, say, so you can claim the other oxygen bonus on there or something like that. If your points, you know, work it out, the heck with doing it via the tableau. The standard projects are just the most straightforward, easy way to get something. There's definitely better ways to do them, but if that pacing can come into play and you can say, oh, I can beat someone to that thing that I see they're working towards, I might have to spend a little bit more to do it, but like, the point calculation is different, then I'm okay doing those standard projects. And I might do one or two of them during the course of a game, depending.
I think the interaction, like Josh was saying, like taking the standard actions to, you know, move something up before another player gets there. Most of the time when we like compare two games, I'm like, I would have both of them. I think this is very much a comparison where like if you told me like I could only have one, in a split second, I would answer you and say I went Terraforming Mars. And I think it's because nothing in Underwater City seems groundbreaking. And I think in Terraforming Mars, like what I want Underwater Cities to have is that communal bit.
I mean, Underwater Cities, I've played it so much fewer times than I've played Terraforming Mars, just because I've had Terraforming Mars for a lot longer. And like right now, Underwater Cities is like, I like it because it's newer, so I'm playing it a lot. But I think overall, I can't imagine it replacing Terraforming Mars for me, just because, like Josh was saying, like I like that more relaxed feeling I get from Terraforming Mars. The one thing, though, I am enjoying about Underwater Cities, when you talk about the communal building and everything, is most times in Terraforming Mars, I end up going for a strategy that doesn't have me on the board. Like, I'm not building cities. I'm not building greenery. I'm not doing a lot there. I'm more doing in my tableau. Like, I love brown building strategies. Like, I love stuff like that. And I look at the the map on the game board at the end of the game, I'm like, oh, like, okay, like I see some people did some stuff there. And I like that in Underwater Cities, like everyone has to be building their city. So I just like the pure toy factor of like, here is my city that I built, versus like a lot of times on Terraforming Mars, I was not the best or the most like obvious terraformer. And again, that is insanely nitpicky.
Even just hearing you say that, it makes me be like, yeah, but then the next time you play, you should try this strategy. And that's what I get excited about going back to Terraforming Mars, is that I always know there's more to discover in that game. And I think that's why it would get more plays for me, is that I know the more I dig into it, there's more to find under there. And I'm always really engaged thoroughly in everything going on in that game. I'm not certain Underwater Cities has the difference of play style. But the two games that I think I won both of them.
I beat you.
Did you?
I want you to acknowledge that on the microphone.
All right. Okay. Apparently Aaron beat me. I don't remember that happening. But yeah, that was a quick game. But I feel like I played really similarly, and I felt like it was more just taking the advantages that were there at the moment. So it didn't leave me to think about strategically what I could do differently, because there's more factors in play than I have control over.
Excluding all the expansions of Terraforming Mars, just in the base box of Terraforming Mars, between all the different corporations, there's more variety for a different type of game than in Underwater Cities, just from the start. Like, just right from the word go, when you have that different corporation, it's a different type of game.
Mm-hmm.
And with Terraforming Mars, you do have there's four different player boards, and we didn't even talk about this. There's some like asymmetrical bonuses that you can get from the player boards in Underwater Cities, just from if you can put a piece down, you'll get a little bonus. And
each
of those boards are double-sided. So like there's a little bit of that kind of like variety, but like they're not really like strategy building for me. Like, they're not really like end goal for me.
But your corporations are.
Yes.
The corporations in Terraform Mars feel like that's mine. Mm-hmm. I'm going to play the sun people, and I'm going to do the sun heat energy thing, or I'm going to do the plant people, and that's going to be my thing. Or like there's even theme in the abilities of those corporations, and there's nice little, just a tiny bit of flavor text, and that's all you need. And I think that's what I like about the game. There's a little hints of flavor text throughout in the cards that kind of engage me. Like, the art is subpar for sure, but there's enough there that mechanically I just really like seeing the way that game works.
Mm-hmm. And Underwater Cities does the flavor text as well.
Yeah,
they're both great games.
Mm-hmm.
We're living in a great time, guys. So moving on, we are going to go into our recommendations. The name of this episode is Habitat Builders, but these might not be habitat building games. They might be other tableau building games, or they might be just games that we want to talk about. Who would like to kick us off today?
I'll go first. I'm just sticking on the Mars colonization theme. I'm going with Mission Red Planet from Fantasy Flight. There's a new edition from a few years ago, because there's an original edition that goes a while back. But it is a very much like player interaction, take that Mars colony game. And it's set in like a Victorian steampunk era where you have little colonizers that you're trying to put onto rocket ships and then blast to different territories on Mars to area control. But everyone uses like cards numbered 1 through 9 in their hand that each have different types of actions on it. So once you play a number, you don't get that action back until you pick up all your cards again. And a lot of them are just like, oh no, I played my saboteur and that rocket's blowing up. So everybody with their people on it, you're not going to Mars.
You're dead.
Yeah, that rocket blew up. Whoops. And it's very much like heavy player interaction, which I usually don't like. But because that's basically just the entire game is quick take that mechanics of like, no, Jameson, take your people out of that zone and put them over there. But then 2 seconds later, Josh is killing my people on the rocket. It's like, oh, this is the game. But it's super fun, and I love any steampunky game.
Speaking of the joy of player interaction between the most insane tragedies and the most incredible discoveries, my recommendation is Cerebria, which is kind of on point because you are, you know, you're looking very small instead of very big. You are inside the human brain and inside the human emotions, and one person is the negative emotions, the other is the positive. There can be a bit more to it than that, but at the end of the day, you are interacting over a shared space, you are controlling territory, you have a really complicated engine building goal that is still brought together in a really seamless and thematic way. For whatever reason, it reminds me heavily of Terraforming Mars, and Terraforming Mars reminds me of it. And you do build some things in it, I guess.
So I actually have two because I can't make up my mind. My first one, which I'm going to mention really briefly, is by the designer of Underwater Cities. It is Prodigal's Club by Check Games, I think. Yeah, mm-hmm. Check Games put that out. It's one of his other games. So if you enjoy Underwater Cities and want to discover more of his, I would encourage you to explore that. In that you are wealthy heirs trying to get rid of all your money or lose all your status. That's enough said about that. The game that I would absolutely recommend, though, is Brass Birmingham by Martin Wallace, published by Rosalie Games. To me, that game has a similar level of emergent depth through repeated plays that we talked about in our broad review or our comparison section, and has that shared map that you're both contributing to. It has the highest level of player interaction in a Euro that I found, because you are contributing to routes and resources on the board and using other players' routes and resources. Lots of subtlety, lots of really clever game design there. So that's Brass Birmingham or Prodigal's Club. Those are my two.
And it's a good thing Josh picked two, because I'm actually picking one that's going to break a bunch of rules, because I'm going to be suggesting On Mars from Vital Lacerda that hasn't even come out yet. I'm a Kickstarter backer, and I think the early pledgers are paid extra to get their copies airshipped or getting shipped out this week or last week or whatever. But Vital Lacerda's games are all very heavy Euros with excellent thematic integration put into them. So I always get really, really excited to play his games for the experience and the challenge of playing his games. This one is going to be taking the Mars colonization theme. We're going to be balancing out, I think, something like six different type of parameters that all play off each other and all need each other through different phases. You get to go on missions. The components look pretty awesome, even in the standard version and not just the Kickstarter version. So to keep an eye out for On Mars. I'm not sure if it's going to be an SRAM release or it's coming out later on this year. But once it comes out, if you like heavier games and you like the idea of colonizing Mars, On Mars. So as we hinted at in our comparison today, we talked a lot about how playing a game and repeated plays of a game can affect your strategy of the game. And basically, it's a lot of like, if you play a game more, you can start to see the strategy of the game and figure out what like the deeper strategies are. And since these are two games that, well, for Terraforming Mars, we know that it definitely rewards you from playing it more often. And from the times that we've played Underwater Cities so far, it seems like that's the same. We thought this would be a good time to talk about it. So that's what we're talking about.
So I wanted to start this with just a question. Isn't improving strategies in that way, isn't that just getting better at the game? Isn't that something that happens with almost every game we play? Or is this more specific? What doesn't this category include?
I think you can get better at every game. I mean, I think you do get better at every game you play. But I don't know if it necessarily falls into, like, better strategy play.
Well, what an example of getting better in a way that isn't better strategy?
I could think of, like, Ticket to Ride. Like, your second play, you're probably going to have better strategy than your first play. But I think between your second time playing and your 100th time playing, I don't know if you're really getting any better at the game.
And it's more so that the strategies are the same.
Yeah.
Like in Ticket to Ride, you're doing the same, like maybe like one or two strategies, versus something for Terraforming Mars, there's dozens of different strategies.
And okay, so you're talking about developing specific plans going in rather than just becoming better at strategizing concerning the game generally, like specific strategies.
I think what I hear when we talk about this is that you're discovering new strategies, that you're discovering deeper layers of a game and gameplay than initially revealed themselves. And I don't think every game offers that. Every game offers different experiences for sure, but these games in particular reward and give you a deeper experience with the game the more involved you are with it. The more you start to know the game systems, the more you can start to see the math behind the actions, the decision-making points that the designers seem to want to call attention to, the further I think you enjoy the game. And I don't know that every game does that.
Yeah, this conversation, it's always great when the conversation definition takes up a couple minutes, but like, I feel like this conversation is more like the ability to discover strategies through repeated plays, like the ability to like see what those pieces of strategies are and like put them together and like knowing what you can and can't do, or maybe it's not.
No, I think that's it. Like, so the comparison I'll make is like sticking with Ticket to Ride. I have played the game so many times. I think I very quickly reached the threshold of different ways to play the game. And at this point, like when I taught my brothers Ticket to Ride, I very easily on the first play could teach them every, can't even call them little tricks, but every little trick I knew about the game, I was like, listen,
the shortcuts.
If you don't want any of the colors that are out there, pick one from the deck first And then if it matches one of the colors out there, then pick up that color because now you have a pair. And I'm like, that's something I learned like the second time I played the game. Like, don't just quickly pick up two from the deck. Like, pick up one, then look at it to see if it matches something. Like, and I'm like, great, you've learned all the little nuances to playing Ticket to Ride in that 5 seconds. While, like, staring at the shelf, looking at, like, Root. Like, Root's a game, when we talked about it, we were like, I don't even want to teach it to new people because your first playthrough, you're not even going to be knowing what to do on the board. Like, you're just going to be like, oh, moving some pieces around. And that's a game where you have to play it more than once to even understand fully what's going on the board with all the factions.
These are game categories that I feel a little bit guilty of, though, sometimes, because these are games I don't want to introduce to just anyone. They're games I want people to really appreciate. Like, when Matt hadn't played Terraforming Mars, I was like, I can't wait to teach this to you. And I wouldn't bring this out to a casual gamer. Like, a game like a Zombicide or an Arkham Horror or something like that, those are experiences that even if you're not playing optimally or perfectly, you're still going to get the game and see what the game has to offer. These games are something a little bit different than that, I think.
The thing, though, I appreciate about these is that in Terraforming Mars, in Underwater Cities, there's at least obvious strategies that you can grab onto and that you can go yep. through and play them and everything. The other week, Josh and I played Franchise together, and it was Josh's first time playing it, and I had played it a few times. And it looks like there's an obvious strategy on the board that you can kind of follow and everything, but without playing Franchise, at least in my opinion, maybe other people will disagree with this, but without playing Franchise previously, like, there's a way to topple the dominoes onto the other player without the player seeing it coming and really capitalizing on that. And that's part of the strategy, but it's hard to conceptualize the pacing of that game. Mm-hmm. And so with Terraforming Mars, that's a game that could play with someone just one time, and then I think that they can get a fun experience out of it.
Yeah.
With something like Franchise, and again, it's a more simple game. This might be just my opinion of that game. Because of like some of like the pacing things that are kind of hard to explain, I don't know if the first play of it is as fun for some people.
I think this also teeters into not just playing the same game, but playing the same types of games.
Mm-hmm.
Because our friend Cody, like, why he doesn't like playing a lot of games with us is because we have the shorthand. That if I'm teaching, like if I'm sitting here teaching Josh or Aaron a game, and to a lesser extent Jameson, like they just, Aaron and Josh play more games, I can, while teaching a game, I can be like, so you know how in this other game you're doing this and your brain goes, got it.
Mm-hmm.
I understand a chunk of this game because I played this other game. So your brain can try to grasp its similar mechanics because, yes, every game is different, but even two drastically different games might share some commonalities. So you know how to look at a board. Like, any of us can look at a board and be like, all right, I'm kind of seeing how some of these actions are going together.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to know all of it, but you're going to know how to put some of the pieces together. And I think for players who don't even, like, for even just less general gaming mm-hmm. experience, strategy is harder to see. Like, I don't think I could sit and teach Cody Terraforming Mars even in a first playthrough and have him fully grasp strategies just because of his general limited board game experience. He doesn't play games even vaguely similar to Terraforming Mars to even on a first playthrough get like, oh, I'm developing an engine in this way. So I think there's even that overlap of just staying in the same genre mm-hmm. makes you better adept to learn a game. And then once you start playing the same game over, that's when you like hone it in. Like, I could beat Josh at Terraforming Mars because I understood engine building games and I understood pacing in games. But to get better at Terraforming Mars, I would have to hone in on that game.
I just want to point out, we've mentioned a lot of times how you've beat me at that game.
I'm sorry. I
think they got it, Matt.
I'm sorry. In case they need to know on their spreadsheet.
We've mentioned that a few times.
It's just there. Because
this has been an episode of everyone being like, no, Josh, I actually did beat you at that game.
It's been a lot of this.
It's because you love the game so much and you play it so often.
Yeah, I know.
That it's like, Josh, I beat you at that game.
I didn't say I was great at it. I was like, but to that point, I think that that speaks to what we're talking about in this meta topic, where I do think these are games that I would like to think, particularly Terraforming Mars, newer gamers could start to learn with. I'd like to think there's enough game that, like, once they learn the actions and the way that it plays, it hooks you. And I think that's what these games offer to me, is that I want to get to those deeper levels of play with these games. And not every game does that. Some games I just want to experience and then kind of put away for a while. But these ones in particular, something about, you know, the end result, looking at what you've done, feels really good to me.
What I don't like is are games where you don't go in and there's an apparent strategy, and that it requires several plays in order for you to find a strategy. Mm-hmm. Because that's not the way I play games. Like, I really enjoy heavy Euros, except for the heavy Euros that don't have an obvious strategy. Mm-hmm. And the strategy is really, you just can't see the strategy when it's just like hidden from you, where you're not going to be competitive or really get a full enjoyment of the game unless you've played it enough in order to really grasp that strategy. And that's just not a game for me.
I even think in the title of a game like Terraforming Mars, it gives you a hint to the strategy. Like, the game is saying, this is what you want to be doing. Mm-hmm. Do stuff to terraform Mars. That's where the points come from in this game. That's a dramatic oversimplification, but there's something to that versus a Euro game that the theme, you know, we use the phrase pasted on a lot, but if the theme doesn't fit the mechanics of the game, it can be harder to see where the points are coming from or what the end game result is going to look like. You know, in games like that, that's when the teach is really important, when you say, this is what you want to be doing in the game. Here's what you want to be aware of. These games reward you for doing what you would instinctively want to do well, I think.
Yeah, I'm really just looking around the shelf of, like, what games reward play? Like, what games don't reward play? Looking at Forbidden Sky, I'm pretty sure I don't even have to play it once to tell you what the strategy of the game is.
Actually, no, we messed up the strategy of that game real bad the first time, but then, like, on the third play, we got it, and then I was like, okay, I beat this game, and now it's, like, on sale at Target for, like, $6.
Yeah.
A game of Scythe is kind of like that, though. The ending of what makes you do well at Scythe isn't always apparent, I think.
I think that comes from there being so many different ways to score and win in that game.
Yeah.
But I like it both ways. Mm-hmm. Like,
yeah,
I like a game where every time I play it, I get to do something different. Mm. And I get to try something different to win. Because that will make me keep, especially a heavier game, that will keep making me come back to a longer game if I can come back and do something completely different than I did the previous time. Like, I don't get overly excited about a 3-hour game where the strategy I'm going to do today was the same strategy I did 3 weeks ago. I'm just going to try to do it better because it's the only real way to win. I just have to be more effective at it. Like, in a really long game, that's boring to me. But in a short game, don't mind. Like, looking at Seven Wonders, could play that game with my eyes closed. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't make it any less fun. And I do like it both ways.
I mean, that's why one of the reasons I love Tricarion is because I will get my magician and I'll look at my school and, like, I'll be like, okay, I'm going to try this strategy this game and we'll see if it works.
I even think in a later game like Quest of Klinenberg, I feel like I learn more, like, seeing what ingredients are out there every time. I go, okay, well, I've played this enough that I know, like, the probability isn't quite there to maybe bet on this strategy. Like, that seems really cool, but I think I want this thing instead because, you know, it's just more likely. I mean, that whole thing is just basically building a giant probability machine.
Me and Quacks of Quedlinburg are on a break right now because I have had the worst luck, like, the last 3 times I've played it. And I'm like, I can't do this. Like, I love this. I love that game. I will come back to that game. I cannot do it right now.
Who else owns that game?
Just you.
Oh, okay.
And it's just every time I played it with you. Oh, that's true. It's just been
Fair enough.
Literally just every single time, cherry bomb. Okay, great. And we are getting late. Yeah. I just got back from vacation. I got some editing to do. So we are going to be wrapping this episode up. I will make a call to the audience because before we started recording tonight, we started trying to rack our brains to think of some different games that we could do comparisons of. So I don't know if we've ever asked the audience, if you have a suggestion for a game you'd like to hear us talk about, please let us know. Send us an email. Do any of, like, I always tell you every week, here's how you get a hold of us. Follow any of those ways. Someone will get back to you. It might take me a little bit on Instagram because I think Instagram is my weakest of all the social medias.
I like that one. I checked that one.
Okay. Then, anyway, if you have a game that you'd like to hear our thoughts on,
or
let
a
us
comparison
know.
Like, yeah. if you're like, oh, I've always wanted to hear these two games paired up, like,
yeah. Other podcasts might have this as a Patreon reward. We're just doing it. Like, if you come
do
at
our
us,
job for us. Yeah,
if you come at us with an idea that we like, we will do it.
Even if we think it's just interesting. Yeah. Like, not even... Yeah, you don't have to, like, try to find games that we would love. Yeah. Like, you just gotta pitch us an interesting idea. And we'll be like, yeah, let's...
We will probably
let's
do
talk
it.
About it.
It'll save us a lot of the work. So anyway, join us in 2 weeks where we did come up with an idea. Our category is going to be Mystery Plus. We're going to be taking a look at Obscurio and Deception, Murder in Hong Kong. Our music was provided by the band Delicious Pastries. If you'd like to email us, you can reach us at menonboardpodcast@gmail.com. Find us on Facebook and Instagram at Men on Board Podcast. Find us on Twitter at Men on Board Pod. We have a guild over at Board Game Geek. Our website is menonboardpodcast.com. Men on Board Podcast is a proud member of the Dice Tower Network of Podcasts. Find other great podcasts at dicetowernetwork.com. Thank you for listening and good night.
Night, everyone.
Good night.
Bye.
Hello, and thank you for downloading Men on Board. My name is Aaron.
Jameson.
This is Josh.
And I'm Matt.
That sounds weird. Have Josh go first.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, it was bad tempo.